and Professor Nasser and Professor. And now we still have some time for your questions. So if you are the audience, if you have questions, please raise your hand, please.
I'm a volunteer from the Voice of Lucheng, a website which tries to bring traditional Chinese culture to a modern world. Dialogue about different civilizations is becoming a trend in the modern world. Last year, Kim Hussein organized the World Conference on Dialogue in Spain, which invited guests from different religions to make effort on contribution of a peaceful and harmonious world. And Professor Fleming extended that Chinese civilization is a civilization of dialogue. A dialogue must be a foundation. Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism are suitable for China. It's for Arabic world, and these involve the Western world. What do you think can be the foundation for the dialogue among different religions and civilization and culture? Communication, human crisis, and mutual respect and tolerance, similar basic values, or the economic situation, or anything else. And what role do you think Buddhism may play in the process? Last question is, could you please explain in detail the way to lead such dialogues to the solve of the serious problems human beings face today in practice? Thank you.
Your question requires about an hour's answer. 3 minutes, so we have a chance to talk more. You know, Alain Singh recently published a very influential book called The Argumentative Indian. You see, Indians are fascinated by argument. They're so articulate. They like to follow, they like to debate. So I said a couple of the books, maybe the dialogical techniques, because of the importance of dialogical relationships. I simply want to say Buddhism, I think Dr. Nasser probably agree with emphasis on compassion and emphasis on renunciation, not just become totally obsessed, attached to what we are now, but have a transcending view of what human beings want to be, is very, very important conversation partner for people like us, from the Confucian point of view or from Islam.
I will say the same thing as he.
Thank you. 尊敬的杜伟明先生，尊敬的胡三先生，请允许我可以用中文来提问问题。非常感谢你们二位今天给我们带来十分有启发性的这段精彩的对话。我先说起吧。我认为在当前我们对于文明可能有存在着三种态度，一种态度就如您所说的是拒绝的，但是，希望您能允许我们说把我问的提问，因为我觉得到后面我只有用中文表达的清楚，实在不好意思。我们对待文明的三种态度可能是一种是，比如说是纯洁，强调纯洁性的，就好像烤羊肉一样。一种是比如说讲究统一的，比如说一道菜虽然各个配菜都有自己的味道，但是它统一在同一个主题之下。但是还有一种态度，就好像鸡尾酒一样，各种菜各种文明都可以发挥它独特的味道，但是又彼此的相同。如果我们对待文明真的是有这么三种态度的话，假如这个说法是成立的，您认为孔子所说的宁可使知之不可使由之，在当前的这种情境下该做如何解读呢？谢谢。
这是一个问题，也是非常好。我简单的回答，就是多半对于宁可使由之不可使由之是完全误会，认为是说干嘛知道是要让推测谁，这是完全错误。这个在法家和道家有的说是，法家是强势，道家是越不知道越好，是吧？唯道无权。儒家的这个观念是一个看齐。人民呢，你要带着他走，他会跟你走；你要想跟他了解他为什么要走，是很困难，因为每一个人他要了解是要经过个人的修养才能了解，所以宁可使之不可使由之是一个事实陈述，而是一种叹息。 并不是认为说是一步到位知道这个行业的走，所以从这方面看起来，当然他希望一种这个综合性，是个基于某个逻辑啊，就各种综合的啊，就是叫做什么顺德而同归，这是比较一个非常重要的观点。好，谢谢。
Okay, please raise the questions in English because Sinasa is in Chinese.
Thank you very much. If you have a question in English, good afternoon. I'm a student in Arabic Studies at Bureau of Columbia in Peking University. And I'm really happy to be in this dialogue. I'm very happy about Islamic Confucian dialogue because I see the interaction between the two cultures and the conceptual similarity between the two cultures, which also occurs to me when I was studying the Middle East last year. And however, it's heartbreaking for me to see there's no adequate communication for learning at the scholar level or international level, even though when I was here, emergency from between China and the Middle East, without the Chinese state province everywhere, from Kanahari to Hamidiya to Tahrir, there's so much interaction and vitality in the business world, in the private sectors especially. And I think there is a momentum for intellectual level communication. And then I'm very interested to know like your comment on the business vitality, you know, the platforms for intellectual communication between two cultures. Thank you very much.
I didn't quite understand when you're asking a question, you're making a comment. but I think you made a comment, and I just make a comment also. There is, you're right, very little interaction at the present moment between the Islamic world and China on the common everyday cultural level. There's a lot of economic activity that's going on, but has very little consequence for better mutual understanding. And if Chinese restaurants have opened up in Cairo and Damascus and Tehran, and Tehran has been a very nice one for the revolution, I've been there for some time. But what is needed is to go, start first of all, from the highest intellectual level, in which I've tried to take a few steps during the last year, a great deal more to do, and then try to come to a little bit more at a popular level. For example, just give me an example, there are some very fine film series that are made now. One very good film was made about the presence of Islam in Europe, which we worked on for some years, and I brought that knowledge to a lot of Europeans, everyday Europeans who were not aware of it otherwise, to make some, let's say, good film or literary works, which deal with this world of coming and going, in which the actors, I don't mean film actors, but actors in the life of two cultures, intermingle and interact with each other. There are, I've heard, for example, they're not planning to make a major film of the life of Nilaputa, the great traveler who started from the city of Pandir, Punjab, in Morocco, and made it all the way to China, and then wrote a famous book in Arabic called Rekha, which means a journey. And they're trying to be a film of it, part of which is going to film in China. And if that succeeds, that's shown everywhere, people will gain an awareness of how these relationships existed. But unfortunately, there's much too little of that at the present moment, and it needs to be done on a practical level.
Sir, I just learned to highlight a little bit of that. The Holy Prophet's saying, though China is far, far away, you must go there in quest of knowledge. Thus, China is engraved in Muslim's mind from the very beginning, since childhood, like you mentioned.
Yes, of course, the famous hadith saying that the Prophet of Islam seek knowledge even if you're in China, or the well of the same. Of course, there are a lot of meanings to that. As some people say, he used the word seen because China was known to be a land very, very far away. Namely, no, seek knowledge no matter how far you have to go in order to find it. Others believe it is something more profound. It has to do with forms of knowledge in China, which were found later on coming to the Islamic world. In the field in which I used to work in my young days, that is the history of early Islamic science, I made the discovery that already in the second Islamic century, elements of Chinese alchemy were already present in the Islamic world. One would expect a jade to come down the Silk Route, but alchemy is a very complicated matter. But you find elements that is the magic squares, magic square of 9 squares, which add up to 15 on each side, which are characteristic of Chinese alchemy, which arrived in China about the 1st century BC of the Christian era, coming to the Islamic world, and other elements. We have treatise on acupuncture in Persia, published it, that written in Tabriz in Persian, showing the needles and the points on the body. Very few people know about this. We discovered this manuscript some years back, and I had it published in Tehran when I was in Tehran many years ago. So elements began to come in. And this remained an ideal in the Muslim mind, that China is a land of great knowledge, of techniques and so forth, and it's a place where one should go and seek knowledge. But the general meaning of it, many of the commentaries upon the hadith, believe that seeing is a symbol of a land far away. Seek knowledge no matter how far it would be. And one person who wrote that seeing for Islam happened to be Yunnan, that is Greek learning, which the Muslims learned so quickly. That of course I do not accept completely, that is of course untrue to that also.
Let me just add one thing. The city of Quanzhou, which was called Zhengzhou in the Song Dynasty, roughly the 11th century, was a great place for magic rituals. And in fact, we still have a lot of students there. That's why I hope that one of these days, not this year, we have a chance to visit and identify for us some of these anomalous Arabic scripts.
Well, thank you. Salam alaikum. Good afternoon, Mr. Chu. And I have a question here. As we all know, in the Islamic world, there is a concept of ummah, namely different states existing as community. And China is a multinational state, and these two facts have confrontations with the popular idea of national states in the world. And how did and how should we deal with these confrontations in today's world? Thank you very much.
One of the very interesting differences between these two great civilizations, the Chinese and the Islamic, is that Chinese civilization is governed by one single political structure, whereas Islamic civilization is governed by many different political structures, many different countries. And there's no doubt about that. We have a very complicated situation in the Islamic world. After the 1st century of Islam, when the first Umayyads were defeated by the Abbasids, the political unity of the Islamic world disappeared forever. That is, even after the Abbasids took over the area from Algeria to Central Asia and the borders of China, they could not capture Morocco and Iberia, Spain, which remained a new Umayyad caliphate. But the ideal has always been there. The complication in the Islamic world from the fact that, first of all, you have on the level of realpolitik, of what's really going on the ground, of the reality of the situation, you have, of course, local dynasties, local political rule. The Fatimids, the Seljuks, this and that, but later on the Great Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Safavid Empire, Persia, the Mughal Empire, Northern India, with the coming of modernism. You have those realities. The unity of the Islamic world was always an ideal, was a civilizational unity, not a political unity. Into this mix came French Revolution nationalism. It's very uncalled Kretchyabucha nationalism, and the word nationalism itself is very problematic. And nationalism in the ordinary sense has always been around. Iman, the prophet of Islam, said the love of one's country comes from faith. So everybody's love is homeland. So what? That's natural to human conditions, like loving one's father and mother. But the idea of nation, the French word nation, that came out of the French Revolution, that all came from the Islam world. And a new wave of European power of nationalism set in, which tried to create boundaries very, very different from the boundaries that existed before then. It is true that the Safavids and the Ottomans, two world powers, were fighting against each other. If you could pick up the suitcase from Istanbul and go to Isfahan, nobody would ever bother you. You did not have passports and visas and citizenship and so on and so on. All this paraphernalia came in, which made the tension between the idea of Darul Islam, the abode of Islam, one big Islamic world where people travel despite local political jurisdictions, that and the idea of the modern nation state, which commands absolute allegiance from those living inside its geographical boundary and who draw the line on the map, this is us, that is them. The tension between that became very great and still subsists. There is today the Islamic world, of course, a strong movement for so-called pan-Islamism. It's always on paper, but the Islamic world is militarily weak. Whenever two countries get together, like when Egypt and Syria got together, or Egypt and Yemen, it breaks up after a few years very quickly. And if Iraq tries to annex Kuwait, as it was in the Ottoman period, 700,000 people die. Because the divide and conquer, of course, is the ideal thing. And just imagine what happened, would happen to the world if the Islamic countries were gone by China. The Islamic civilization would have one single governing political power. The whole history of the world would change. Everything would change. From the price of oil, going everywhere else. So if you prevent that from happening, you see the situation that you have. Petty little countries, the leaders really never being elected, therefore having no power, always relying on someone in the foreign office of some country calling them what to do. I can say this, it's very little in Washington, D.C., otherwise there's the rest of the government back home. In such a situation, it's a very, very difficult thing, and this tension continues. The Islamic world is not going to be solved so easily. Look at the 22 Arab states. They're trying to get together a so-called Arab unity. Arab unity is as close now to its realization as it was the day it was created, which is very far away. And I think of one step closer to that realization.
Thank you. Since we have no last time left, so the last question, the last part of the question.
The lady there is prepared
to
get
on.
Oh, you are
not.
Oh, no. Sure.
Equality of sexes.
Okay. Actually, I want to bring this question from another perspective. Because I also attended this meeting this morning, so I found that actually all people who have their speech are all men. And actually most of the participants are all men. So on one hand, we are talking about the hundred years of the different civilizations. But on the other hand, if the man and woman statue, the rights are very unequal. So how do you feel this? And what do you think of the women's rights in the future, in your future blueprint of the Confucian civilization and Islamic civilization? Thank you.
It's impossible for a conference to take place without us being asked. I think the women were so wise, otherwise I wouldn't be sitting home with Bethesda, Maryland, and that'd be nice coffee while my wife would have to come sit up and watch you a lecture. I wish that were the case, but unfortunately that is not. I mean, there's very complicated social and educational economic factors
that moved over the ages, and now we have a rebellion in the West, one sect against the other, and certainly by Alexander Graham Bell, it's still very strong.
Repercussions in other cultures and other civilizations.
Thank you very much.
I think that this there going to be changes, going to be changes that will come about.
Please,
but what I am against very, very much
Yes.
For the West to dictate again what's good for the rest of the world. That is not right. That is some Western woman in New York coming and saying, oh, I feel so sorry for that Afghan woman in Afghanistan. She might change her life so she'd be like me. This kind of pride is never going to work anyway. But I think that within the societies, there are transformation changes taking place. Oftentimes going back to original religious teaching, which have been put aside. Again, I want to talk about China, but in the case of the Islamic world, there are many Muslim feminists in the sense that Muslim women who are trying to go back to the teachings of the Quran that say about marriage. Marriage is, the Quran is not about sale, in which you have a beautiful daughter, you collect all the money for a husband to come and marry her. In India, it's even worse. In Hindu India, it's worse than in the Islamic world, where you have to have camels full of gold to get married. Sort of rising against these social customs, which became established, sometimes for economic necessity, sometimes as a result of various historical processes, sometimes because of agricultural ways of living, which necessitated certain types of economic bonds, and a world in which these things no longer hold. Which would be living in an apartment on the 9th floor someplace in Cairo. I think changes are bound to come about. What is wrong is this new form of colonialism, which tries to say what I am doing in New York is the right thing to do, everybody in the world has to follow. And I know what is good for everybody. And this is a great deal of reaction against this, and I don't think it's going to work. It's for China to work out its situation of women, it's for Iran to do the same, it's for Egypt to do the same. It's something that every society has to take care of for itself. You cannot generalize. Every social situation offers certain advantages, certain disadvantages. My daughter, who now works in the National Art Gallery in Washington, she's an art historian, she's a doctor in art history, has a much more difficult life than my mother, who never had to work. And my daughter oftentimes say, why did I get all these degrees? I wish I would like my grandmother, somebody could support me. Of course, now she's free of getting to the metro and go on. There's a check that she puts in her pocket, but she also has to spend a lot of money because the men today no longer allow the men at all. Old Muslim men who never allow their wives to spend anything for anything because they thought it was their responsibility. So they give them debts. It's not that everything was terrible in the old days, everything is wonderful today. If that were the case, you would not have 60% divorces in the United States and all that is going on. It's a very, very complicated question, and it's not going to be solved by just one question. The important thing is to respect the cultural integrity of each society. It's a part of the civilizational dialogue. And not for one civilization to dictate to the other what is good for them.
I take your question absolutely serious. I think for the last 50 years, there have been two movements that really changed the world, landscape of the world. One is the ecological movement, the other one is the feminist movement. And in fact, if you look at what's going on now, say 50 years ago, you know the difference. Questions of relationship within family, even the definition of question of power, the question of religion and age, question of human maturity. Every question of the human experience is being reached. So I think I agree with Dr. Nasser, this is not looking at the world. This will happen. To me, is something to be celebrated. I would say the Christian tradition itself has been very male-oriented, as most of the pre-modern spiritual traditions are. If you look at Catholicism, women cannot be priests, there are no cardinals or popes. So this situation is a major challenge to the Confucian tradition. My sense is that if the Confucian tradition cannot meet this challenge, the Confucian tradition will not survive or should not survive. But the situation is fascinating. One historical observation, one contemporary observation. Historically, the most important personality that helped the Confucian values to be transmitted from one generation to another generation, to now not to be the prophet, not the literal office, not the scholar, not the official, but the mother. Some has the mother who's not in the 17th century, one Confucian scholar was constructed by his mother to follow the footsteps of two fatherless sons. One, of course, was Confucius. His father died when he was only 2 years old. The other one is all there. It's the mother mentions whom and so on. And the contemporary situation is fascinating. If you look at the situation in China, most of the people, especially there, want to become engineers, physicists, and of course in computer science and business and so on. So the humanities, this is in cultural China, all over around the mainland China, Taiwan, Singapore, and overseas Chinese, humanities are now dominated, I don't want to use the word dominated, in a way continued by women's arts. And so the cultural transmission to China, this is the first generation, second generation, if you look into the future, the legacy will be preserved, developed, or destroyed by women. So how the tradition is going to survive depends very much on the support of women as a whole. I'll give you one example. The largest women university in the world is Yuhua in Korea. So once I gave a talk about a possible Confucian response to the feminist critique, and the lecture was arranged for me to talk at Yuhua with 6,000 or 7,000 brilliant women students. And that afternoon, I heard, said, this afternoon we're going to crucify Mr. Duke. And sure enough, they assigned quite radical feminists to be my counterparts. But the conversation actually lasted for a long time. And then for the end, they said, okay, there's a point of agreement between your understanding of Confucian tradition from our feminist point of view. But we want to wait when we give you a lecture as a new one, the famous Confucian university, to see whether you only talk about your idea here strategically, or if you believe in what you say.